People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
Imagine just for a moment if all affordable housing was green. It is a noble goal, and if our guests on today's episode have their way, it will happen in the next 10 years. Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing. I'm Joanne Green, and I'll be moderating a panel discussion with some of the nation's leading experts in the field of smart growth and green building. Jonathan Rose is the CEO and founder of the Jonathan Rose Companies, a mission-based policy, planning, and real estate development company based in New York, and the co-founder and chairman of the Garrison Institute. Dana Borland is Vice President of Green Initiatives for Enterprise Community Partners and leads environmental strategy for that national organization. And Linda Mandolini, Executive Director of Eden Housing, one of California's oldest and most respected nonprofit affordable housing developers, is on the Network Advisory Board for Enterprise Community Partners, and in 2009 launched a comprehensive green initiative at Eden to improve the efficiency of its older housing stock. Eden's been committed to green building since back in 1973 when they installed their first solar hot water systems at the Josephine Lum Senior Apartments. Currently, Eden has a goal of reducing energy and water consumption by 10% a year for 3 years and to reduce trash generation by 10%. Welcome, Jonathan, Dana, and Linda.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Jonathan, let's start out with an overview of the Garrison Institute and what you're trying to promote in relation to climate change.
The Garrison Institute is a new organization about 10 years old, housed in an old monastery, and we use the monastery and the ability to reflect, to think deeply about issues, but then come up with real solutions. We run a program called Climate Mind and Behavior, which also has a program called Climate Buildings and Behavior, which asks a very simple question. How can we shift people's behavior in buildings to be greener? And we're looking at two kinds of behavior, the behavior of the people who run the buildings. You know, you have a really green building and a lousy superintendent who messes it all up. So you've got to get your staff to be greener, and also how can we green the behavior of the residents. And what we found is that green behavior is a subset of pro-social behavior, and when you create more pro-social behavior, you have healthier, happier, better, more efficient, safer buildings. So it's a virtuous circle.
This is a tall order because first, even before you change people's behavior, you have to change their attitudes, right?
Well, they co-evolve. But also what we found, so the Garrison program draws a lot from cognitive and neuroscience, so we're there's a method to this madness. We're really learning a lot about how people function. So very often, when you tell people something, it goes in and out. You know, you know this with your teenage children. But if they do something, it becomes embodied and it becomes real for them. And so so often actually getting people to do greener things, like, for example, look at recycling, the spread of recycling throughout America, has really shifted behavior. So part of it's about action.
Right. Now, all three of you participated in the Garrison Institute's Climate Buildings and Behavior session held back in the spring of 2010. That gathering included not only nonprofit developers, but also commercial property owners and for-profit developers as well. How did it go, having all those parties at the same table?
It was terrific. It was, you know, a perfect opportunity for us to, you know, really integrate across our professions to think about these issues of how do we engage in behavior change, us individually as well as in the places where we're working and through the initiatives that we're each leading. So it really, I think, was energizing for everybody, unleashed some great innovative thinking and just broadened our sort of perspective on things that we are in control of that we can actually make a difference towards behavior change in this area.
Now, that's Dana Borland, Vice President of Green Initiatives for Enterprise Community Partners. Jonathan?
Tremendous advances are being made to the greening of buildings in their design and construction, particularly through the Enterprise Green Community Guideline, which is a program, which is a whole standard for how to make green buildings at low cost. But We're in a very cash-constrained time. This is a difficult time in the economy, and affordable housing never had any spare money. And what's so great about behavior change is that it costs very, very little. These are all strategies to create healthier and greener buildings without having to spend money. And so they're particularly appealing not only to the not-for-profits, but to the for-profits, which have seen lots of rent drop recently.
So would you say most developers at this stage are concerned with environmental impact?
We're seeing a rapid increase in the understanding of how to, of both an appreciation for environmental impacts and an understanding of how to mitigate them, but also of the value that it creates for buildings. There's a lot of data that shows that greener buildings are more valuable. And we know that buildings that are greener in their operations, the greener that reach out to engage their occupants in being part of the solution, tend to have higher occupancy levels.
Dana, Enterprise Community Partners has a comprehensive green initiative that deals with new construction. With shrinking resources, is it becoming more challenging to ensure that new affordable housing construction is green?
And I would just also say, though, that our Green Communities initiative applies to all construction types. So from the very beginning, which was 2004 when we launched Enterprise Green Communities, we've been addressing all types of affordable housing, both newly constructed as well as moderately and substantially rehabilitated housing. And so I think cost definitely is coming into play. And, you know, it's interesting to see, though, in some of the evaluation we've done on green communities developments for those development sponsors that met the criteria, what we learned was it actually just, you know, cost just under $2,000 to meet the measures that had to do with energy and water, which returned $4,800 in lifetime utility cost savings back to the development. And so to echo what Jonathan Rose was commenting on, owners of affordable housing are definitely getting that green measures payback in so many ways, both in operating savings as well as in just better living environments for the residents themselves who then want to be there, want to stay and help continue to make it a better building, as well as just add to the community and to really strengthen the surroundings of that particular development through greener strategies. So as, you know, cost continues to be an issue, I think we all are working hard to figure out how to bring overall cost down to deliver affordable housing. But specifically for the green measures, I think developers are really beginning to understand that it doesn't have to cost more. In fact, it costs more not to engage in this way of thinking. And we have some really great tools now after 6 years of leading this effort that both Eden Housing and Jonathan Rose companies have been on the forefront of helping us to deliver that are now supporting that integrated design process that needs to happen up front through the construction process tools that we're helping to create and then getting to the operations and maintenance piece. And we have both grant funding as well as some manuals and templates and some new tools to support that type of work through the life cycle of the particular building.
So new construction is one thing and retrofitting older housing is a different issue. I know that Enterprise has done a lot of work in the area of asset management and retrofitting existing buildings. Can you tell us about that, Dana?
Sure. Yeah, we really have begun to look at really, you know, if you look at it, two tranches. One, all the existing buildings that were never designed to be green. What are some things that we could begin doing today? You know, that asset managers can have a role in working with property managers to really integrate into the building today. And so we've developed a toolkit that's on the greencommunitiesonline.org website. And then we've leveraged about $31 million to address retrofitting of existing affordable housing stock. And the key, I would say, to this work so far has been engaging in a comprehensive green capital needs assessment of the existing building to figure out how is it performing today, where are the opportunities to make some improvements, and integrate that into sort of a refinance for that building. So address some existing things that can be done today in buildings through some green asset management techniques, and then you know, at the time the buildings are ready to be refinanced, let's get in there with a green capital needs assessment, complete that, and provide the right type of financing to make those improvements happen. And, you know, in between that time, continue to make the improvements that we know we can today, both with new appliances and actual hard things in the building, as well as changing the behavior of people operating the building and living in it so that we can recognize some real savings today.
And Linda, Eden Housing's been engaged in retrofitting older housing stock as well. What has the impact been?
Well, you know, we started last year work on some comprehensive retrofitting initiatives across 40 of our properties in the portfolio, and we had done an assessment across the portfolio of what their properties would need, looking at three things: energy, water, and trash, because we thought if we kept it relatively simple, it would be straightforward. And we were lucky, I think, that we were fairly well positioned to move on funding that came through the stimulus package at the federal level so that we could do solar retrofitting, which, quite honestly, solar is a challenge because it's not exactly free. It's kind of an expensive option. But we've been looking at other things that are really simple, like insulation, better appliances, low-flow toilets, top-loading washers are also high water users. So we've been switching out to front loaders in our laundry rooms and in some of our units where our residents actually have washing machines. And we've been pretty amazed by the savings. We just really started the retrofitting work mid-year last year, and I would say on cost alone, we're saving between 18% and 65% on water and energy, which has been pretty amazing for us. On garbage, we're also saving probably about 25% by having implemented a tenant behavior initiative on recycling. Multifamily recycling is not easy. It's not a given. A lot of cities don't want to do multifamily recycling, and so you actually have to really work with your tenants and your staff to get them engaged in recycling. And so we've been able to drop one trash pickup at every property where we've implemented a recycling program, and that saved us about 23% in our trash bills. So it's really interesting. I wanted to just go back to Jonathan's point about bringing together for-profits and nonprofits and what we all have in common. We are in common, we're all focused on the bottom line. Like, we all care about whether or not we can generate sufficient funding to cover the cost of running our housing. In the case of the for-profits, they care about the profit they make on their bottom line. In the case of the nonprofits, we can't raise rents a lot of years because of the restrictions that the programs come with that we work with. And so for us, we really care about making sure that we're operating our buildings really efficiently. And we also care, I think, about the greater good. A lot of the tenants really want to do the right thing by green because it affects their income. And we have a lot of low-income tenants, and in resource-constrained times, they actually have more money in their own pocket if they save money on their utilities. So, you know, we're really motivated a little bit by mission here at Eden. So it's been a really interesting quest so far.
Jonathan, would you say that is really one of the effective tools in helping to change people's behavior, is helping them to see areas in which they can cut their own costs?
Absolutely. And so one of the interesting emerging fields now is our feedback systems. And so I call this the bill meter switch circuit. So anything that has a bill, like an electric bill, a meter that can measure, and a switch that allows you to turn it on or off, can create a positive feedback loop. So, for example, we have found that one of the things we're doing now in all the affordable housing projects our company is involved with is getting permission from the residents. We actually put this in the lease for them to let us look at their utility bills. We can do this online, see it directly. First of all, when we're designing new green buildings or green retrofits, we want to make sure that we're actually getting the savings that we modeled that we were going to get. And one of the great things we're finding out is that green buildings actually are delivering the savings to the residents. And those savings are real dollars in their pockets. And as you know, for low-income people, if you can save $30 or $40 a month in utility bills, that's very important to their bottom lines. But the other interesting thing about this feedback system is it also lets us see if we're not getting the savings. So, for example, we finished the building, 50 units, 49 units are all performing perfectly. One has huge utility bills, which the resident was not complaining about, and it let us go in and see what the problem was in the apartment so that we could fix it. In this case, it was a misadjusted thermostat. To help them with the savings. What's happened, the next generation, which we're seeing, though, is real-time feedback systems. So you're going to see very soon the ability for people on their iPhones to, actually, we're testing this in a new building called the Tapestry, a mixed-income building, where in half the units we're giving people on iPhones or other devices the ability to turn on and off every single appliance. So, for example, a microwave that is just sitting there and not being used, the clock uses more energy per year than the microwave itself, because the clock, you can't turn the clock off and it's just there running, consuming electricity. If you could go to your iPhone and turn that off while you're away at work or whatever you're doing during the day, that's a feedback system that begins to give people more control of their energy. So we're seeing that as the next level.
That's fascinating. Now, is the strategy that you've been talking about really focused on one building at a time, or is there a way for you to expand it to a whole neighborhood, for instance?
It's very important to expand a whole neighborhood, and we actually have another program at Garrison called Climate Cities and Behavior that is then looking at how do you move beyond the individual to the neighborhood. But one of the great things about the community development world is CDCs tend to be neighborhood-focused and tend their assets tend, not always, but to be clustered in specific neighborhoods. But what we're finding is when you go to the cognitive science of the individual, to the cognitive science of the group, that there are tremendous group benefits, basically known as culture or social norms, and that when you can change a norm in a neighborhood, if you get enough people to tip the culture, then it spreads through social networks. And I don't just mean Facebook-type social, you know, electronic social networks. I actually mean the human-to-human social network. Then you can have a much more rapid adaption and much bigger impact.
Linda, I'm curious to know what your experience has been. If tenants don't pay for things like trash and utilities, for instance, how do you then encourage them to change their behavior?
Well, we've actually, when they don't pay for things like trash and utilities, we've been coming up with incentive programs. We've done a couple of things. First, we've gotten the children involved. We find that parents want to do initiatives that their children are engaged in. So we have a technology program called the Digital Connectors, and those kids have been working with the residents on how to create digital kits on how to be more energy efficient or how to be greener in your lifestyle. And so the kids are making videos for their parents, and they're bringing them home, and so we're teaching the kids how to do video editing at the same time that they're teaching their parents how to be greener. So they like to, the parents like to do what the children are encouraging them to do, because they want to encourage the children to be in the technology program. So it's a little bit of a sleight of hand. The other thing we've done is simple things like the trash program. When we implemented the recycling programs at the properties, we basically said to the tenants, if you save money in the program, then we will share that savings with you by creating more programming for the kids in our after-school program. And we've actually found that it's been enormously successful. Folks have been really interested. We also have a lot of residents who are interested in being green for the sake of being green. Mm. And I think one of the things I learned at the Garrison Institute was that altruism is a fairly significant motivator. And what we've seen both with our staff and with our residents is that there's a range of motivations. And at our senior properties, the seniors have really enjoyed being green for the sake of being green. They have really enjoyed having recycling be a new initiative that they're working on, as have a lot of the kids. A lot of the children are, you know, they do Earth Day at school. They are celebrating being green. And so they're very much motivated by the whole notion of greening the universe. And that's actually been kind of rewarding, because you don't have to convince them to do initiatives. Then the other end of the spectrum are the folks that are motivated by saving money. So if they're not saving their own money, then there's some benefit to them when we have savings. Hopefully over the long term, it would allow us to lessen our rent increases, perhaps, or maybe even give rent discounts to tenants if we could save enough money.
And when you put these two together, the personal economic motivation with the larger altruistic motivation, you're actually capturing two different parts of the brain, and the synergy is even bigger. You get a very sticky an enthusiastic response. And so one of the issues is that there are things you can do that have a persistence problem, that people are very enthusiastic the first month, and by the 10th month, they're not doing it anymore. So this combination of altruism and personal benefit, we find not only sticks around for a long time, but actually tends to grow in behavior, because the altruistic part is the part that spreads from person to person, and it's what makes it. So if you're saving money for yourself, you generally just keep it to yourself and don't talk about it. But when you're doing something to make the world a better place, that's something that's shared, and that's the part that really gets it to be a whole-building activity.
And that also, it seems to me, would be more the long-term benefit, whereas often those savings are quite short term. Dana, were you going to say something?
I was, actually. You know, I think this is it's so interesting to see what's been going on here at Enterprise as we've been working on these green initiatives, coming up with resident engagement tools, to then see the energy within our staff of about 500 staff across Enterprise to realize, wow, I can actually go home and do these things. You know, the vampire energy that Jonathan was referencing earlier cost all of us together $3 billion a year. Well, I can actually go home and unplug things, put them on smart strips, and I can save money, as well as, you know, I'm extending what I do during the day to work on green initiatives. And then, you know, with the development sponsors and the residents that we're working directly, we're all engaging in this green economy, you know, in the larger conversations we read and hear about related to climate change. And so it does become very sticky very fast, that you see there are solutions that are within your control that you can engage in professionally as well as personally, and then talk to your neighbor about. And similarly, we've seen great success with developments that have shared with individual residents how their energy use compares to their neighbor, you know, not by name, but then the sense of accountability is heightened. And, you know, if your neighbor is not turning off their lights, then maybe you'll say something, or you'll certainly think about turning the water off as you're brushing your teeth. You know, so it just continues to snowball, I think, as we realize our role in all of this and the actions that we take every single day, we can actually be changing and really making a significant difference in our wallets as well as to the greater planet.
And I just wanted to add to that, that, you know, I feel like the whole notion of how you recognize the accomplishments and is critical to the success of this. We've been working a lot with our staff on recognizing the achievements that have been happening in the buildings. Even though we're fairly early in, we were recognized at Eden with the California Sustainability Award last week, and we were pretty excited about that because we feel like we've really just started. And, you know, we're about a year into this comprehensive effort. We've been building our new buildings, have been very green for a long time. It's our older buildings that we've really been focusing on, and a lot of our localities have been recognizing the achievements of our staff and our buildings on water savings and other items that are important to them. And that kind of recognition goes a very long way with our staff in terms of pride of ownership and pride of initiative. And so we've been really excited about that. And I think that is a critical component to the sustainability of this whole effort. And Joanne, the other thing that I think motivates people, and you know, here in California, everybody, a lot of people like to drive their hybrids and their Priuses. And as you may recall, a few years back, the reason a lot of people started buying those cars is because they could be in the carpool lane with a single driver in a Prius. And there's a certain element of, is it relatively easy for me to do this? And if it's not that hard, we've been finding that people can form the green behavior as a habit. And it's much easier to encourage that habit. And so we've been really looking at, you know, how do we make it easy for the residents to do this stuff so that it's not impossible and, you know, it's not a huge challenge that you can actually do this. It's pretty straightforward. And within a year, it's actually something you do every day.
Well, right. I mean, I remember a time when we actually had to think about putting our seatbelts on, whereas now you would just never drive in a car with that one. Linda's based in California. Jonathan, you're in New York. Dana, you're with a national organization. Do you see these same patterns of behavior clear across the country, or, you know, is it starting in the West?
Great question. I think it may There are pockets where we're seeing more of it, certainly in the West, but also in the Midwest and in the sort of Mid-Atlantic Northeast. But we're seeing examples of it everywhere. The one I just gave about the residents knowing what their energy bill was related to their neighbor was something that came from Denver. And we have examples of similar activity in other states in the Southeast as well. So it's terrific to see that this is beginning to surface across the country.
That's great. I want to talk about how you measure success. Jonathan, do you have a way of gauging the success of your behavior change initiatives?
Yes, we're actually partnering with the U.S. Green Building Council and setting up a website with them to actually track these behaviors. A group of the participants of the Garrison program formed a committee and came up with a measurement protocol, basically looking at BTUs per square foot as a method. And now what we're asking everybody to do is, as they implement a strategy, do a before and after. So, for example, I mentioned to you this, we're now in a mixed-income housing project implementing these smart outlets that allow you to turn on and off your microwave, et cetera, from afar. So we're actually, the outlets are running in background right now, and we're developing 3 months of just background data on every outlet, how it works. And then when we switch on the smart function, we'll be able to compare it to a baseline. So we're trying to do that methodology, baseline data, and then implement the behavior change and compare the data, compare it universally in terms of BTUs per square foot or dollars per square foot in terms of savings, and then upload that in USGBC so that everybody in the world has access to this information. And hopefully they'll see the good ideas and the behaviors will spread.
What about you, Linda? Do you have a way of measuring the impact of your green initiatives at Eden?
Kind of embarrassing because I'm not nearly as technologically advanced as Jonathan. We're sort of in the Luddite mode. We're literally right now collecting utility bills and trash bills and creating spreadsheets and really looking at what kinds of monitoring systems we could acquire online to really do this more in real time. I think one of the challenges that we have is we have a huge number of properties. We have enormous numbers of utility bills because every property has a whole maybe 10 to 20 meters, depending on how big the property is. And PG&E is in the middle of changing all of our meters to smart meters. And there's no easy way to aggregate all of the utility district information online. And it's not automatically uploadable. So we've actually been spending a lot of time looking at how do we really get an effective measurement tool? How does it link to our systems corporately for monitoring our utility bills and paying our bills? And how do we collect all that data and aggregate it so that we can better analyze it? Right now, we're literally doing the sort of pen and paper version of that because it's much harder, I think. It's easier said than done right now on older buildings.
Dana, are there any specific policy initiatives at Enterprise that would make it easier for affordable housing developers to green their buildings?
Well, I think, you know, just to close the loop, too, on the collecting the measures of success, that is indeed helping us to inform policy, having evidence. And so we, too, have been collecting not just energy data, but economic health and environmental outcomes. And, you know, it's interesting, even on the health side, changing behavior related to the cleaning supplies we're using and some of our ventilation techniques that we're using in our homes is having a significant health impact in terms of upper respiratory health and lowering asthma or symptoms related to asthma. And so having the evidence in hand, which Enterprise has also been really intent on collecting since day one, is important to making those policy changes. And so our goal in terms of policy is making sure that these requirements for green are just embedded in the regulatory framework of how the federal government, the state and local governments are helping to deliver affordable housing. And so we're looking at all of the federal policy to just make sure that all policy related to affordable housing that is directing public subsidy that way has requirements in it for green. And we really are looking to make sure that all affordable housing is green by 2020. So it's not just in the NOFAs, but really embedded in the regulatory policy.
It seems like it would probably be easier to build a green building from scratch than it would be to make older buildings energy efficient. Is that true?
I think it depends on your personality, maybe. You know, I think newly constructed buildings, you have a site, so you don't have a completely clean slate, but you have a lot more room to really think about what you're going to achieve on that parcel. And so if you, you know, sort of position that way to really like looking at all possibilities, then you might think it's easier. With an existing building, you certainly have constraints, but then that narrows your focus. And I think there are some great tools for both looking at opportunities with new construction as with existing buildings. So, you know, it might be a little tougher to look at an existing building to achieve everything you might possibly want to do. But I think we're all getting more innovative about how to reach green deep goals within existing buildings, certainly. So I haven't done it. So John, I've been interested in your response.
My sense is it's easiest to green a new building because you're starting from scratch and you have the best opportunity to integrate. So, for example, we can if we add more insulation to a building, we can downsize the boilers. So it's the easiest to shift capital costs and operating costs, but reallocate how one invests. Existing buildings that have tight budgets and older entrenched populations and older systems are in some ways more difficult. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity for savings because often just tuning things that have kind of gotten out of tune, out of time. I'll give you an example. It's midnight on a Saturday night, and the pipe breaks, and the guy comes in, and he fixes it. Your wonderful trusted plumber, he closes all the valves, he fixes the pipe, and it's late at night, he opens all the valves except one. And for the next years, you have pumps pumping, still circulating water, but they've got to pump around this one forgotten closed valve. That happens in all of our buildings that are, it's on some other version of it. And so we're stuck with all these kind of legacy issues that finding them when you take a fresh look and try and green a building can be very, very helpful. But you're less likely to get as many bottom line results as you're going to get with a new green building. When we do a retrofit, a fairly comprehensive retrofit, so a real serious capital improvement on a building, it's often the great opportunity for this in the tax credit world is the year 15 buildings, which is really a time in which often we're putting in new roofs and it's a time to be doing other things. That is probably the best time in an existing building to create a comprehensive green program. But Linda, I'd love to know your thoughts.
You know, I actually agree with Jonathan. I think it is much harder to green the older buildings than it is to build a new green building when you're working from a clean slate, particularly here in California with a lot of communities that really want to do green building. They have green building guidelines or requirements in their own building codes, and they are very enthusiastic. And a lot of the cities in California help us pay for our new projects. So they have very long laundry lists of green features that they would like us to include. So we actually think it's a lot easier on the front end. It's not free, which is the challenge for us. We have to sit with the cities and help them prioritize on which features are the most effective and impactful on the front end. But I think it's a lot easier on the back end. It's much harder with older buildings. And I agree that it's the year 15 recapitalization event that's actually extremely important. We've been doing a lot of work on our buildings because of the stimulus money, because we had some opportunity in the middle of that year 15 life on some of our buildings. And that is a lot harder because you have all these lenders and investors and other parties that care about what happens to the building and care about the investment in the building because it affects their tax position. And that actually is not necessarily a straightforward problem to solve. So we've been working a lot to educate our lenders and investors. And our goal is actually to have our capital planning process have a list of green priorities so that every year when we do capital improvements in the building on our on an annual basis, that the green initiatives really rise to the top. So the changing out of toilets, all of the stuff that you can't do in one fell swoop, you would do on a unit turnover basis, or you do annually as part of your annual capital planning initiatives, because it is so much harder on older buildings. I think you can change behavior a little more easily in older buildings because the tenants all kind of know each other, mm-hmm. and so you have really good critical mass. And so we've been able with our services staff to create really good initiatives in buildings where we have already really well-established communities. So I think the behavior stuff has a lot more traction in some of the older buildings than it does in a new building where people don't really know each other. So it's been really interesting, I think, to look at this because we have been really thinking hard about how do you get to your ideal in the older buildings and how do you get there with really limited resources, because sometimes you need to do stuff that isn't necessarily green improvements just because the buildings are old. You have to spend your money on your major priorities. So, yeah, I agree with Jonathan.
And one of the things I think with existing buildings that we're really trying to encourage wider practice of is looking at the existing building and applying that integrative design process to how we're retrofitting it. I think sometimes we think because we know the building, it all seems pretty obvious what improvements need to be made, and it's more a matter of, well, where are we going to get the capital to make those improvements? But oftentimes, if you haven't done the necessary testing and really, you know, sort of that thought process of how's that building working as a system, as a whole building, then sometimes decisions that are made in isolation for individual components of that building don't play well with other improvements that then are made, and you may be expending resources for items that, had you thought about it more holistically, you could have saved money. So I think there is some sort of practice that we need to change with existing buildings to help make it easier and really inform our decision-making process that we have begun to recognize and applied to how we approach newly constructed green buildings.
It seems to me that behavior change really does underlie all of this moving forward. Jonathan, if you had a policy wish list, if you will, that would help to create incentives for behavior change, what would that look like?
I don't have one. The biggest wish list is simply that by understanding that the goal of every policy is to shift behavior, the goal of every regulation is to shift behavior, if we just became more knowledgeable about that and began to design our policies and regulations so that they were more behavior cognizant, I think that'd be great. And by the way, some of these behaviors are very obvious. I'm going to give you an example. Most building inspection systems require that the plumbing, the gas lines, the electric all get inspected by special inspectors when a building is built. And these are very important for the safety of the building. But we have nothing that actually requires the inspection of insulation or any of the energy or caulking or any of the energy efficiency items. So a state can have a great building code, but without an inspection process, contractors often ignore these things and under-install what they're required. So I know that this isn't what first comes to mind when we think about behavior, but simply by adding the inspection of that to the building inspector's checklist, so the inspector went around with a ruler and measured to see whether you really had 2 or 3 inches of insulation, would immediately shift the behavior of the construction industry. So there's some very obvious things like that. There's some very subtle things, social networking things. And if we just applied behavioral thinking to the full range of the building construction and operating and design realm, I think we would be creating better, more integrated and better operating buildings.
Any wish list items, Dana or Linda?
I think my overarching wish list is just for greater alignment, particularly across federal policy, so that the various agencies are reinforcing each other's message of energy efficiency, public health, and transportation efficiencies, and so that we're really integrating those federal policies. So that would be my overarching wish.
And Linda?
Mine runs, I agree with Dana on better alignment, but I also just wish there was more money to do some of the work, particularly some of the work on existing buildings. I think we've had to narrow it down, but I think we've sort of really focused at Eden on trying to maximize our investment in our buildings. I just wish it would be easier to do this work with older buildings, and I think I wish there were more resources to help us do it.
I want to thank all of our panelists today. It was a great conversation. And, of course, just the beginning, right?
That's right. Yes.
Jonathan, thank you for having us.
Oh, you are very welcome. Jonathan Rose, founder and CEO of the Jonathan Rose Companies and co-founder and chairman of the Garrison Institute. Dana Borland, vice president of green initiatives at Enterprise Community Partners. And Linda Mandolini, executive director of Eden Housing. You can find a lot more information online at www.garrisoninstitute.org, also at enterprisecommunity.org, and of course at our home base, edenhousing.org. I'm Joanne Green. Thanks for listening to the Affordable Housing Podcast.